Welcome back to Herpetological Highlights. This is episode 184, and I am Ben Marshall, co-hosting, as always, Tom Major. And, oh boy, we've got a weird subject for today's episode. I think possibly one of the weirder ones we've done, because we're talking about one of the most alien herpetofauna, I think, that are out there.
Yeah, whenever we talk about them, it always feels like we have to actually start by telling people what they are, because I feel like a large percentage of humanity are not aware that these things exist. We're talking about Caecilians, this group of limbless, worm-like amphibians characterized by their elongate, sort of cylindrical form.
They look like a snake. The asteroid worm from Star Wars.
Yeah, they do. They look like quite a few worms from
science fiction.
I feel like they do inspire a lot of stuff. And they're like, when you think about them at the scale that they exist, they're kind of crazy. Like, we've likened them to sharks. They're like these underground subterranean predators with these insanely sharp teeth. But yeah, they're amphibians.
They do have quite shark-like faces, weirdly.
They do. And a lot of them don't have eyes, or the eyes are like completely embedded inside the head. So then they look a bit, you know, they look even stranger than just a mouth. But they also have tentacles that can pop out of their face that they use as a sensory organ, kind of like a snake uses its tongue. They have these two tentacles between the eye and the nostril on the sides of the head, and they poke those out and use those to decide where to go and see what's around. So yeah, very strange creatures. But we're talking about the parental care in this species today and how it might allow the animals to transmit microbes to their juveniles. So the paper is by Quetti, Bletz, La Bombard and Woodhams and Blackburn, 2023. Parental care contributes to vertical transmission of microbes in a skin feeding and direct developing Caecilian, published in Animal Microbiome. So we're talking about microbiomes.
Oh, microbiomes. What is a microbiome?
Yeah. So
don't tell me it's a little biome.
It's a small biome, micro, and it refers to the community of microorganisms that inhabit a particular environment. In this case, we're talking about the skin and guts of Caecilians. So this includes things like bacteria, viruses, fungi, and archaea, the other weird one. And yeah, when we talk about the microbiome in the context of Caecilians here, we're referring to the microorganisms that live in and on their bodies, mostly in like the guts, the gastrointestinal tract. Of course, humans have microbiomes too. I mean, I don't know how many species. I don't even know what
the range
is.
There's a percentage, isn't it, of bacteria, or a ratio of bacteria cells to actually what would be considered our cells. And it's surprisingly skewed towards bacteria, I feel.
Isn't it like 90% bacteria?
Oh, it's something. I can't remember what the percentage is, but it's higher than you'd expect. And it's microbiome stuff. It's outrageously important. Like, it has so many surprisingly fundamental roles in animal life. It's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, it is ridiculous. It's kind of, we're not really an animal. We're just like this giant tower of ecosystems.
Yeah.
But we're talking about Caecilians. So let's take it back to this particular Caecilian species that we're going to be talking about. So we're in southeastern Cameroon in Central Africa in a biosphere reserve called the Jar Biosphere Reserve. And we're talking about Herpele qualastoma. And this is a Caecilian which doesn't have a common name as far as I could see, which is a little bit disappointing. So we're going to have to call it Herpele qualastoma, which is a direct developing Caecilian. So the eggs hatch straight into mini Caecilians. There's no larval form. They don't have any kind of a weird swimming around phase. and the eyes are not visible. They're covered completely with bone. And their tentacle is like really close to the nostril, which is kind of weird. Usually it's like closer to the eye. These ones have it close to the nostril. It's purpley gray, so it's quite a nice color. And like I said, they lay eggs, and they don't just lay eggs. They actually look after the eggs. They sit, they sort of attend to the eggs. The mother attends the eggs. And then when the juveniles hatch out, it starts getting even weirder because they practice dermatophagy, which is skin eating. So the juveniles sit around with the mum and they eat her skin. And, you know, the female goes through a host of changes here to like develop skin more quickly so that the juveniles can grow on it. She even changes color, turns like pink because of how much her skin is having to regenerate quickly, apparently.
It's a bizarre setup. It's absolutely a bizarre
setup. It's weird. Yeah, so dermatophagy, the skin eating, They'll also use fluid provisioning. So not only are the juveniles eating the skin, they'll also use what's called fluid provisioning, which is a really polite way of saying they squeeze some juice out of the cloaca and the juveniles drink that. The babies drink the cloaca juice, and that is nutritious and good, along with the skin. So pretty disgusting diet that these juveniles are existing on initially. But, you know, loads of animals provision their juveniles in loads of different ways. We shouldn't judge. They probably would think milk was disgusting. And yeah, the microbiome. We're talking about it in context of microbiome. So is there a benefit of these Sicilians' babies spending time with the mother?
Yeah.
In terms of,
I suppose it's
the microbiome.
More of a question, because so in the introduction, they bring up plenty of examples of it occurring in like mammals and birds and things, and that's relatively sort of well looked at and identified. But the amphibian examples where you have nest attendants or egg attendants or care, like glass frogs and things, they don't tend to have this transfer of microbiome between the adults and the offspring. So to have something that's a very direct parental care and parental provisioning of food, like the Sicilian, might present an example of an amphibian that's doing something different from previously studied amphibians, be that salamanders or glass frogs or whatever. So I feel like that's sort of the motivation here, is the Sicilian might be, I mean, obviously it's quite unusual. You've just described a whole suite of unusual traits, I would say, but it might be additionally unusual even in amphibians when it comes to this microbiome transfer.
Yeah, they characterize the kind of little communities that were on the skin of the juveniles and the adults.
And, sequencing, right?
A whole bunch of sequencing.
Yeah.
Yep. And they pretty much demonstrated that the rubbing around on the mum, basically the skin of the mother, eating the skin of the mother, and also just being in contact with the mother, promotes gut and skin microbiome transmission from the mother to the juveniles, especially on the skin though. They really get a lot of the mother's microbiome onto their skin, and they do get some in the gut by eating it. Although the adults they found had a more diverse gut biome than the juveniles did,
yes,
which they attribute to the fact that the adults are eating lots of different things and the juveniles are just eating skin and cloaca juice.
And the females tended to have more diverse gut biomes than the males as well. Adults, I mean.
That's cool. Are they a different size?
I don't remember seeing a comparison of size in this paper. I don't know. Because you're niche partitioning, I'm assuming.
So, but it could, I guess, be because of the juveniles.
They do have a different diet.
Because
previously observed differences in diet between male and female affect their skin and gut.
Okay,
yeah. So there is a previous documentation of different diets.
So they're eating different things, they're getting different microbiome bits and bobs. They were getting microbiome elements from the skin of their food. But this is making me think, you know, it must be snakes as an example. I mean, there's a few snakes that do this, that have nest attendants in the females, and the females rub against the babies. And I don't know that there's anyone looking at microbiomes on the skin of snakes, on snakes.
I would put massive money that there are people looking at the microbiome on snakes because of snake fungal, whatever it's called.
Mm, yeah,
because there is no way that that doesn't interact aggressively with skin microbiome, whatever.
Yeah, that's very true.
Communities.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the whole nest attendance versus non-nest attendance thing. We'll have to have a look. It's pretty cool. But yeah, so these babies are apparently receiving, I mean, you can only safely assume it's benefits from being so close to the mother and stealing some of her microbiome. This is obviously something which happens in humans too. Humans, when we have babies, we keep them close to our skin. They get loads of microbiome rubbing off on them that way. They also, you know, during birth, they get a bunch of microbiome stuff, and also through the milk. So, you know, it seems weird because this is an amphibian which is eating skin and it's drinking cloacal fluids.
Yes.
But actually, it's one of the ways in which amphibians are probably more similar to us because they are sharing the microbiome in the same way that we do.
Yeah, the other aspect too is that they were showing that it's the microbiome of these juveniles seems to be not coming from the environment as well. You can imagine an animal born and raised and existing in a fossorial, muddy domain that they'd be getting a lot of microbiome sort of diversity from the environment and the soil around them, but that doesn't seem to be the case. And I think there was some aspect they were sort of suggesting that it's kind of weird how little microbiome or little sort of bacterial diversity on the Sicilian matches with the environmental bacteria. They're sort of little islands to themselves, these Sicilians, and not just a reflection of the bacterial community that they're sort of living in amongst in the soil. So, yeah.
They are an ecosystem.
Yeah, they sort of are, yeah. There was a sort of additional question mark left at the end of this paper, though, which I've got to touch on, that like 60% of the diversity in these juveniles couldn't really be accounted for in terms of origin. So not entirely sure where those bacterial or where those sequences are coming from. They offered a couple of explanations. One is that it might be a sort of artifact of the being able to identify the sequences to begin with. So just a sort of methodological quirk. The other is that it's coming from food that they're eating, because these Sicilians, even at a very young age, will be feeding by themselves anyway on little arthropods and tasty fossorial bugs.
Okay.
There is a possibility that a chunk of their microbiome, certainly gut microbiome, is coming from what they're eating outside of the skin of their parent.
I didn't realize that. I thought they were just solely skin eaters, but they're actually eating other stuff as well. It's quite
cool. Yeah, well, this is what they're sort of suggesting is filling that gap.
I guess they have to wean off skin sometime, if you call it weaning, which you definitely don't.
I suppose there's no reason to not use that word.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a bit sort of mammal-centric, but yeah, why not?
But yeah, it's a weird one.
Have you got anything else about the microbiome of Sicilians?
No, not really, other than just to re-highlight that these are weird as far as amphibians go, it seems. And I don't know if anybody thought of these strange little creatures as uncaring. I think that could be put to rest, because it's a pretty compelling set of results showing this shift of microbiome from parent to young'un. Yeah, weird.
I also just love how every single paper about Sicilians starts with a line which something along the lines of, Sicilians are the most understudied animal that has a spine. Just like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is also the trick with them, is they're damn difficult. Being all underground.
Mm.
Them and the worm lizards, dude. They don't make it easy.
No, they do not. So let's move on, shall we, to our species of the bye week. Okay, so we've got a paper by Li, Liu, K, Cheng and Wang, 2024, a new species of Amelops from Guizhou Province, China, published in Zoo Keys.
This is a beautiful frog.
It is a cool frog. We're headed to Defang County, remember the name, Guizhou Province, southwest China. So we're talking about, yeah, a new species of frog, which has just recently been described. And it is a very cool looking creature, isn't it? We haven't done that many frogs lately. I feel like there are a lot of frogs which are just kind of like, it's a bit brown, whatever. Like, it's cool, but there's a high density of frogs being described. Not all of them make the grade. But there was absolutely no question this one was going to slip through the colour net.
Or some of them are very vibrant, mossy green, I would say. And with dark, I was going to say splotches, but it almost gives like a maize-like patination to it.
Yeah, and they have varying degrees of it as well. Some of them are kind of actually sort of mostly goldy coloured on the back, whereas others are just like completely...
Yeah, it's like they've been lightly cooked or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas, yes, the others have got sort of like a lot of green taking over the background pattern.
And beautiful gold eyes.
Very nice eyes. And you mentioned the moss, Ben. The moss, because in the paper, they found like the most beautiful patch of moss to put these frogs down to take the pictures. And it is really nice. But actually, it's relevant because according to their little description, we know insanely little about the behavior and ecology and of this frog. Like, it's obviously still a mystery. It's just been newly described. But yeah, one thing we do know is that there is a lot of moss where they live. The fact that they found some moss to take a picture of the frog is actually pretty spot on. And the habitat's amazing. It's like this beautiful stream surrounded by lush vegetation. It's quite high altitude, isn't it? 1600 meters.
Yeah.
And what have they called it? They've called it Amelops dafangensis, because it's from Dafang County. So, yeah, Dafang dwelling.
Dafang cascade frogs is what they're...
That is the common name of the group, isn't it? Proposed. Cascade frogs. Yeah. Yeah, which is cool because they live near to cascades. And this one's no exception. It's yeah, literally living along. The picture they took of the habitat is like a really nice waterfall. So, yeah, that's spot on.
Only quite, what are they? They're about 4 centimeters SVL, 4.5.
Wow. Yeah, so they're pretty small.
They're pretty little. They're pretty little. You know, but that's kind of standard for these described frogs, I feel.
Yeah, yeah, that's probably about average. They do get, obviously, frogs do get a lot smaller than that, but.
They also get a lot bigger.
So, yeah, in the last 5 years alone, there's been 25 new frog species described from Guizhou province in China. So, yeah, pretty speciose frog density area. Cool.
And now there's a new one.
Nice new species. Nice new species. Amelox daphangensis. Do they give it a common name?
Yes, Daphang cascade frogs.
Oh, we said that. Yeah, yeah. Great stuff. Solid common name. All right, wicked. So, yeah, have you got any other business for this episode?
I do not have any other business for this episode. I'm quite satisfied with our chat about Sicilian skin eating and a beautiful new frog.
Okay, wicked. Well, I have got a little bit. We had a message from one of our patrons, Paul. Paul said, "Hey guys, you've possibly gotten similar responses already, but two elaborations on the piebald episode, both regarding spider morphs." So this is going back to
yes.
a couple of episodes or two ago where we were talking about piebald royal pythons,
yep.
which or ball pythons, and the control of the piebald mutation from this particular gene,
yes.
Sort of being talked about and being sort of established for the first time. So then that led to us talking about spider morphs, which are it's another kind of mutation in royal pythons, which have kind of like, instead of their normal dorsal patterning, they have like almost like a spider. It's not really a spider web. It's more like a series of sort of jagged patterns. It just makes them look quite striking and different. And it affects the coloration of the rest of the snake as well. They tend to be like a little bit more brightly colored. But yeah, so I was talking about those in the context of the fact that they wobble when they're moving around. And I thought it was a neurological defect where they basically had something in their brain, which is what everyone used to say to do. And that was sort of the reason why they were kind of wobbling
yeah.
around like
yeah.
this. But Paul has informed us. He says, first, it turns out it's not a neurological defect. There was a paper last year that identified the defect as being in the inner ear. So they have permanent vertigo
oh.
or the snake equivalent.
So it's a balance thing. Oh, how
yeah.
how wonderful.
yeah, horrible, right?
God.
And he says, second, my understanding, though I don't have a citation, is that it's been shown that the jaguar morph in carpet pythons is the same mutation. I think it probably is. It looks the same. Everyone sort of says that. And he says it definitely presents similarly with corkscrewing, etc. So yeah, this mutation in the spider version of royal pythons causes this issue with their development. And so I looked up a paper. And yeah, Paul's absolutely spot on. It's by Stark et al. In 2022. And they didn't have enough individuals to actually conclude statistically that spider royal pythons were different. So it's like not like proven, but they just looked at four and they compared it to the normal morphology. And they had this different inner ear structure.
Huh.
So it's interesting because the spider mutation that causes the change in coloration is a mutation of the melanocytes, which are pigment producing cells that are responsible for skin and eye color. And when the animal is developing, the melanocytes grow from a particular group of stem cells. And these same stem cells have an interaction with cells that become the inner ear when they pass by them during development.
Yep.
Animal development's pretty crazy.
Yep.
They basically rub up against it, it seems
yep.
like. And when they do that, those stem cells have an impact on the development of the inner ear. And if they have the mutation, which changes the formation of the melanocytes, these same stem cells don't have the same interaction. And so then the inner ear doesn't develop properly, and yeah, it leads to this situation where the snake has difficulty with its sense of equilibrium, which sounds horrible actually. It's
yes,
way worse.
It does, like when, yeah.
Yeah, having vertigo, yeah, it's really, really sad actually. Yeah, I'm imagining people who have spider royal pythons will not like to hear that. It's really quite sad. So yeah, I don't know, you don't know how they feel with that, but you can't imagine it's particularly nice. I mean, if you've never known anything else, I don't know, but
it's
that was really
well,
interesting
yeah,
point
so
from Paul.
That aspect aside, it's absolutely fascinating that that's been sort of ID'd as a connection. And it shows
yeah.
the complexity of this, you know, a gene to development to sort of a trait or a phenotype, and how difficult that is to wrangle and predict and control in any meaningful way, right? Because that's...
yeah, it's absolutely mad.
Yeah.
It's mad how a gene that controls the appearance of the animal can also have this underlying effect on their inner ear morphology, and you just would never know.
Right,
if you looked.
But is it really that, though? Because you're calling it a gene that controls colour. Sort of by definition, it isn't that anymore, is it? It's a gene that does colour, eye, and inner ear.
Yes, yeah.
A gene's only what we define it to be. So it's if you work backwards the other way, it's...
And apparently humans know most about these, about genes that influence melanocyte development, which is pigmentation, because they have these physical repercussions that humans love. Like, we love animals with crazy colored coats. We love animals that are like piebald, skewbald, you name it. We're just like, well, that looks cool. Let's like selectively breed that. But apparently this effect that we've just been talking about of the inner ear development being related to the skin color development, apparently it's been known about in mammals since like the 80s because of this reason. Like, it's been well established that you shouldn't use certain varieties of mice in scientific experimentation because they have these strange traits associated with their color variety.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's...
We could have probably seen this coming.
I wonder if it's similar genes again, though.
Yeah. Don't know whether the control is exactly the same, but
right, because that's what was weird with the paper we were actually covering that episode, is that it seemed like that gene would do different things in different groups, even within reptilia. So it's fascinating. Fascinating and complex.
Yeah, it is. But yeah, really cool. So thanks, Paul.
Yeah.
For pointing that out. And yeah, great correction. Spot on. Like, yeah, really, really fascinating to see that. I suppose that wasn't, maybe it was bigger news, just didn't see it at the time, but yeah. Very cool. So the only other thing I've got to say is one other piece of any other business. We had a new patron called Phoenix. So shouts to Phoenix.
Thank
Thanks
you.
Very much. And yeah, if you want to become our patron like Phoenix, you can. It's the best way to support the podcast. We love it. Patreon.com/help highlights. But otherwise, listen for free. It's all good. So yeah, I haven't got anything else.
Excellent. Well then.
If you, like Paul, have got a correction or a comment, you can get in touch with us via email, herphighlights@gmail.com, or through our social media avenues. Yeah, I think that's it. Thanks for listening.
Excellent. Thanks for listening.